Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. On today's show, my guest is Rick Steves. If you've watched public television in the last 20 years, you likely know him from his travel shows, Rick Steves Europe and Travel with Rick Steves. Our discussion covers how he turned his passion for travel into a business, as well as climate change and travel, why it's important to say yes to travel opportunities, and his new show, The Art of Europe. Keep listening for more on Outdoor Explorer. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer, Rick.
Thank you, Martha. Nice to be with you.
I also learned from reading your website that your sister participates in the Iditarod here in Alaska, or at least she used to.
Yeah, she completed the Iditarod, and she just was a big part of her life. Now she's still a big fan of the Iditarod, and she's got her dogs with her wherever she goes.
That's great. I'm absolutely thrilled to be able to speak with you today. Your show plus the Viking River cruise pamphlets that my grandma got when I was little were what fueled all of my travel dreams as a child. So it is wonderful to be able to speak with you today.
Nice. Well, it's a joy to be with you and to enthuse about the beauties of travel.
Yeah. So I think we have a lot to cover. But before we really dive in, can you just give us some quick background on how you turned travel into your job? Because I think that's probably something that sounds really great to a lot of people.
Yeah, it is kind of an interesting thing when you turn what you love to do into your job. And it's kind of risky because for a lot of people, I think it's dangerous and it ruins what you really like so much because you've monetized it. But I found ever since I was a college kid, I've been teaching travel and it never gets old. I'm really thankful I found my niche. I'm 67 years old now and a lot of my friends are retiring at this age, but I just feel like, why would I retire? I love what I'm doing and I'm making a difference. And it's like my fountain of youth. Before this, I was a piano teacher. And my dad was a piano tuner here in Seattle. And I remember he started importing pianos from Germany. And one day he came home from work and he said, son, we're going to go to Germany to see the piano factories. And I thought, that's a stupid idea. But, we went to Germany and saw the piano factories and went up to Norway to see the relatives. And it occurred to me as a 14-year-old kid, this is not all that bad. It was pretty cool. Did a couple trips with my parents. And then ever since I graduated from high school, I've been spending my summers in Europe. I was a piano teacher. Kids wouldn't practice in the summer. So I thought, I'm not going to struggle with that. I'll see you in September. I'm going to Europe. And I became, a good traveler. I was learning from my mistakes and year after year on a very tight budget. And I found I was spending a lot of time teaching people how to travel. And finally, I decided, I had 50 piano students and I was teaching classes about how to travel in Europe. And I had a recital hall here in Edmonds, just north of Seattle. And I decided, I got to choose one or the other. Am I a piano teacher or a travel teacher? And I decided to give up my students, much as I love teaching piano. And I turned my recital hall for my students into my lecture hall for my travels. And I've been doing that ever since I was in the mid-70s or the late 70s. And I'm doing the same thing now that I was doing back then, except I have 100 wonderful colleagues that work with me and technology beyond my wildest dreams to amplify my teaching, like what we're doing right now. And it's just, I love it. And it's interesting to me that it never gets old. I've spent 100 days a year in Europe every year, except for the 2 years of COVID. And I'm still learning. And I'm lucky because I work hard and I produce something that's worthwhile. And I get direct feedback from people just like you. I mean, I think you've been part of my life and I didn't even know it until I met you because you travel with me through the content that we produce and through the travels that you've enjoyed.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I watched a few of your videos on YouTube and was reading some of your blog posts while I was preparing for this show. I watched the Best of the Alps video, which I highly recommend, especially for people mm-hmm. who love the mountains. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the hike that you did recently around Mont Blanc? Because I think that sounds really interesting.
This is one thing that continually impresses me is how you cannot exhaust Europe of what it has to offer. And Europe is my beat. Of course, you could travel anywhere. You could travel in the United States and Canada. You could travel south of the border. You could travel in the Pacific Rim. But I just love Europe. And my mission is to equip and inspire Americans to venture beyond Orlando, try something farther away. And Every year I check my guidebooks and I work on my tours and I make my TV shows and I do some new things. And even after doing this for decades, I am finding new wonders in Europe. And one of those lately has been venerable long distance trails. And these are just a culture in themselves. And we film some of these things, and sometimes I kind of fake that I'm doing the hike with the TV camera because we've got a lot of stuff we have to do that's not enjoying the mountains. And this is one of those things that we faked that we hiked around Mount Blanc, and we just stayed in a couple of mountain huts and did the hike between them. And I thought, I'm coming back. I got to come back and do the real thing. So what you watched was the little fake thing. And then I went back the next year with my girlfriend and we actually did the hike. And it's a 10-day, 100-mile hike around Mount Blanc through three countries, France, Italy, and Switzerland. And you don't do any summiting. You go from about 5,000 feet where you stay in your little hotel in a village, and you hike 3,000 feet up to 8,000 feet to a ridge. You have your little picnic there, and then you hike into the next valley. And you do that essentially 10 times, 10 miles a day, and you go all the way around the circuit. There's a similar hike in Washington State around Mount Rainier, but it doesn't have all the culture and the mountain huts and so on. And we kind of cherry-picked it. We just did it in a week. We did 10 mile hikes in 6 days and took public buses through the boring parts. And we hired a company to arrange our hotels with a nice dinner and do a Sherpa service to take our bags ahead. So we just had our day bags. And I'm no serious hiker, but we really trained for it. I had all the good gear and I fell in love with my hiking poles. And it was a great experience. So great that we spent another week hiking in the Alps just a couple months ago, a year after that first big hike. And that was great hikes in the Berner Oberland, the area south of Interlaken. And what I wanted to do there was lace together venerable mountain hotels from the 1800s, like 150-year-old hotels, mm-hmm. that were 2 hours a hike above the nearest paved road. And you really have to hike into these places, and they have very little electricity or hot water or anything like that. They're helicopter stocked, and they're filled with people who hike there. And each day you hike for 8 hours, and then you work up an appetite and you hang out in this beautiful hotel and have a wonderful dinner, and you do it again the next day. So we did that, and I'm a big fan of it now.
Yeah, that sounds really wonderful. I'm sure that sounds really wonderful to a lot of people who live and hike in Alaska, because there's nothing like that here. And my perception of hiking, especially in the Alps, I'm sure there's parts of Europe where hiking like that is not as accessible, but my perception is that it's much more accessible in many places because of those experiences, those mountain huts, and the ability to go from accommodation to accommodation without having to worry about camping or anything like that.
It's sort of like glamorous camping or whatever. It's glamping for hikers from hotel to hotel. And you could hike from France to Slovenia and never come out of the mountains, and every night sleep in a great hotel, and every day enjoy a different hike. I mean, Europeans really get into their mountains, and I like the whole culture thing too. So I love the pristine nature like you'd have in Alaska or here in Washington State. But I also like the fact that you've got different cuisines and you've got different traditions, and we were hiking on Roman roads, and we were dropping into medieval churches, and we were checking out traditional farmers making their cheese. And it was a beautiful thing. You watched the show, and people can watch it on Alaska Public Media, or they can stream it there or on my website at ricksteves.com. But we have a 1-hour special on the very best of the Alps. And I just love the Alps. If you think of the Alps, Martha, it's like a symphony of mountains that arcs from Vienna, if you can picture Vienna way in the mm-hmm. east of Austria, all the way to Marseille. In mm-hmm. the south of France, where the mountains plunge into the Mediterranean. And there's a poster that is a kind of a dream view of the Alps from above Munich. If you went in a drone straight above Munich, about half a mile, I think, you could look at this whole thing. And I just feel like a conductor when I'm conducting all these snow-capped peaks. And every bit of those Alps has some intrigue and some natural wonders and some culture wonders and some great huts and great food and great people to meet. And again, it's just one wonderful dimension of Europe, which is one wonderful dimension of this beautiful planet of ours.
Yeah. What advice do you have for somebody who might be a more experienced adventurer in their home state or home country, but wants to apply those skills to traveling abroad? One of the things that we talk about on this show, or that I've talked about on the show, is being a beginner. And you mentioned that in your blog post about one of your blog posts about your trip around Mont Blanc, that you all of a sudden you were like, man, we were beginners, but like, we're getting really good at this.
Yeah.
Shedding our layers and putting our layers back on. How do you take what you're comfortable with and apply it to a new place where you might be really uncomfortable?
Well, it is fun to be steep on the learning curve, isn't it? When you're,
yes.
Especially when you're on an adventure, an outdoor explorer adventure. And I really like that. I've never done a serious hike until we hiked around Mount Blanc. I mean, I've done a 10 mile one day hike many, many times, but I didn't know if my body could do it 6 days in a row. That's not my thing. But we enjoyed training. It was a great sort of COVID activity. And then we got over there and it was, doing this during the pandemic was interesting because there is no COVID up in the mountains. It just wasn't even on people's minds. I mean, what was on people's minds was all the natural beauty around us and how good the food tastes when you're 5,000 feet up and you've been hiking all day. I just love that. Anything you are doing when you travel, you do it with the wide-eyed wonder of a child, and you don't do it as a sophisticate. You're just new, you're trying out the wine in Florence. I've just been having fond memories of making a fresco at an artist studio in Italy, and a fresco like Michelangelo did on the Sistine Ceiling. I did a little 1 foot by 1 foot fresco, the same basic process, and it looks darn good. I had a guide helping me out. We go to cooking schools. We go to the dog races. We sit in a sauna naked with a bunch of Finnish strangers. We play backgammon in turkeys, sucking these 3 foot tall hookahs, like these big bongs. We paint tiles in Portugal. We go to bullfights in Madrid. We smoke pot in Amsterdam. We go to the pubs in Ireland where they're way on the West Coast, where they stand on the bluff and they look out at the Atlantic and they say the next parish over is Boston. And then you step into the pub and you wipe the condensation off your glasses and you order a Guinness and they say, this is the strangers are just friends who've yet to meet. There's all these wonders that these can be first time experiences. And a lot of people are in their hotel room watching TV, and a lot of people are out there getting out of their comfort zone, having a good experience. And I think it's interesting. I've been thinking about this lately, Martha, that culture shock is an interesting concept. And a lot of people treat culture shock like the enemy, like protect me from culture shock. I don't want to get out of my comfort zone. It'll ruffle my ethnocentric feathers. But no, culture shock is a good thing. It's the growing pains of a broadening perspective. And when done right, how much culture shock you enjoy, it's like skiing through the moguls, or, it's like taking out your boat in a little bit of a chop. And I just think culture shock's a beautiful part of travel. And I intentionally get out of my comfort zone. Some of my favorite travel experiences over the years have been going to places I'm not supposed to go. Oh, Cuba, Palestine, Iran. These are great places to travel if you can do it. And I wouldn't go, I'm no crazy thrill seeker going into a war zone or anything. There's lots of places I wouldn't go and I wouldn't feel comfortable going, but there's a lot of places that we're told not to go that are perfectly good to go. And they carbonate your outlook. That's for sure.
Yeah. I think you mentioned this already, that one of your goals is to try to get people to basically experience the world, get out of their comfort zone and learn about things outside of their immediate area. And obviously travel is a great way to do that, but I definitely, not planning every moment of your day or not having expectations is something that I learned. Not having concrete expectations about what your experience is going to be like is something that I learned about traveling. The specific example I can think of is when you go to a place where you don't speak the language and you order off of a menu and you think you're getting one thing and you get something completely different and you're like, well, this isn't what I ordered. You just sort of accept it and move on. You eat it if it's not something that's going to harm you or that you're not allergic to.
Right.
You eat it and you enjoy the experience rather than being upset and saying, this isn't what I ordered, and sending it back.
Well, there's two kinds of travelers, aren't there? And you're one with that attitude, you're one. And the other is the one who demands something else because I said that and you didn't understand me. Well, I'm sorry, darling, you were in another country and they didn't understand your language and it's not their problem.
Right.
So you need to have that attitude that if it's not to your liking, change your liking. Exactly. I've been taken as a tour guide. We have that's a major part of our work is we take 25,000 people around Europe every year on 1,000 tours. And we had our best year ever in 2019 and then zero in 2020 and 2021. And then we opened the gates again this year and we had 25,000 people on 1,000 tours. We're just wrapping up that season. And we advertise our tours in a way that attracts people that want to have these adventures. And we're pretty straightforward with our groups. You know, if it's not to your liking, change your liking. You don't have to go home and like this, but right now you're in a land that is evangelical about cheese and you're going to eat some stinky cheese, whether you like it or not. And I know you grew up like me where cheese was orange in the shape of the bread. Here you go, cheese sandwich. But in France, it is special. So for a little while, you're going to be a cultural chameleon. You're going to embrace different ways to eat and drink and have fun. And then when you go home, you can be really glad you're back home, or you can bring a little bit of that Europe with you. And that's this fun souvenir.
And I think one thing that people don't realize if they've never traveled abroad before is that asking the locals how or what or any questions about their local culture or their food, they want to share that with you. They want to tell you about that. They don't want you to try to pretend like you know what you're doing.
They want to
help you.
You are right on with that observation, Martha. And as a tour guide, I've noticed that a lot of times people travel to Europe with their little chest of goodies from Texas and they want to show off how great their state is. Put that down. You're over there to be wowed by them. You're not there to tell them we're better and bigger and so on. And I know that a lot of Americans are almost a little put off when a culture is really good at something. But for me, they're not saying they're better than us. It's not a competition. It's just they're enthusiastic about something and they want to share. I don't know if you remember this, but when I was a kid, we had show and tell at school in like third grade. And on Monday, you know, everybody would have a moment and it would be show and tell. And it's just people sharing what they're excited about. And when we're in travel, it's constant show and tell. And I'm just saying, bring it on. You know, this is fun. I don't know chocolate, but when I'm in Belgium, I really get into the fine points of chocolate and I'll spend a lot of money on more expensive chocolate. I don't drink whiskey in this hemisphere, but when I'm in Scotland, I drink whiskey every night. And I don't play petanque every day, but when I'm in France, I'm very often playing petanque with new friends. That's like boule, you know, this where they throw the metal balls around and see how close they can get to the little cuisine. When I'm in Turkey, I don't let a day go by without going into a tea house and challenging a local to a game of backgammon. This is what you do. You know, this is what you do. And it's all good travel. And ironically, in so many ways, the less you spend, the more you experience. And we're all about experiences these days. And some people are good at that. Other people need to work on it. But what really distinguishes your trip, what makes the experience sparkle and be memorable, is how many people do you meet? And not how many ladies in a dirndl who bring you a pretzel because that's part of the show. But how many real people do you meet that don't see you as a dollar sign, but as just part of the party? That distinguishes your trip. And some people are natural extroverts and some people aren't, but all of us can be good when we're on the road at meeting people.
Yeah. Something that I think about when I'm hiking around in South Central Alaska is how many views I've seen that so few other people in the world have seen. And most of my favorite views happen to be from the tops of mountains. You've traveled all over the world. Do you have a favorite view? One that gets old, you know, one that you remember that sticks out, or one that gets old no matter how many, that doesn't get old no matter how many times you go back to it?
Yeah, I love my view here north of Seattle. I look out and I see Puget Sound, and on the other side I see the Olympic Mountains, and I see boats going out to sea. I just love my view. I never get tired of it. I'm very blessed to have this. And I've got a friend in Switzerland who lives in a little village where there's no cars and where everybody's got the same last name. And he's the school teacher and he has a little back porch like I have a little back porch. And he's got a grand view like I've got a grand view. And his view is the side of a mountain across the valley. And he knows that mountain intimately, everything about that. And I love sitting on his back porch And just hearing him talk about the animals and about the farms and about the cheese and about the avalanches and about the moonrise. And he's so close to his nature and I'm so close to my nature. And it's really fun to realize that we have two completely different natures and they're both just gorgeous. But that's one view that comes that I never get tired of.
I love that. Kind of talking a little bit more about some of the travel experiences that you've had. I don't want to rehash all of them because you have so many of them, but I do want to touch on this one because I think it's something that the listeners of this show would find really interesting. In the late 70s, you traveled from Istanbul to Kathmandu. And I bring this up for a couple of reasons. One, because it's a trip that's basically impossible to do today. And two, because I think it illuminates something that we as a society are not good at. And that's the taking the opportunity to do things, especially when it comes to travel and recreation, or making the time to do things that we dream about, because you don't know when those things are not going to be possible anymore. And I think that trip probably illustrates something similar. But if there was one part of that trip that you could give everyone the opportunity to experience, what would it be?
Well, first of all, that's a philosophy of travel. When the opportunity presents itself, you should probably say yes. And I can just think of many times when I say yes and I'm thankful. And I can also, I got to admit, I've said no a number of times and I regret it. My girlfriend and I were just in Switzerland having this wonderful, wonderful 1 week vacation. And we opted out of doing the Via Ferrata, that cable walk across the cliff. I've done it before and I wanted to share it with her. And we had just had a full trip. And for some reason, we just kind of got lazy and we didn't do it. It was going to be the finale. And we so regret not taking that opportunity to do the Via Ferrata. When I was a kid, of course, the big thing for backpackers was to go from Istanbul and Turkey all the way across India to Kathmandu in Nepal by bus. And everybody was backpackers and it was just the hippie thing to do. And it was the greatest travel experience of my life. I wrote a 60,000 word journal over the course of that trip that was hidden away for 40 years. I never read it until COVID. And then I had time to read some of my old journals and it was an amazing story. I was 23 years old and it had sat there in darkness for 40 years. And then I read it and it was so good. It was before I was a travel writer and it was just sort of like an anthropological dig into a 23-year-old kid's life named Rick Steves. And I asked my staff, because I was keeping my staff employed and I was paying them and we didn't have anything to do really during COVID. So I said, why don't you guys type up my journal and make a book out of it? And I had some great photographs from that trip and we made a book out of it. It's called The Hippie Trail and it's not for sale right now, but I use it for public television. I mean, it's available when people pledge at Alaska Public Media, but it's just a book I made as a thank you for people pledging to public television. But long story to get to your question, what was something I remember on that? First time I ever smoked marijuana was Afghanistan. That was really exciting. It was going out on a dugout canoe in Nepal in a little tiny lake up in the mountains and then docking on the other side and taking a hike through the jungle and watching leeches attack us in slow motion. Going to the incredible markets in every great city. For me, coming across Khyber Pass, you've just been through all this arid country, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and now you're coming into the Indian subcontinent and it's suddenly very humid and very lush and fertile. And you've come a long way and you've never been there before. But when you cross Khyber Pass and you come into India, you feel like you're coming home. It was the weirdest thing. I was coming home to a place I had never been before, and that was India. And India is my favorite country. And I could talk all day about India. I just would say those were memories that I treasure. And the experience was great. And you're right, it'd be tough to do it quite like we did it today. But I would say people, men and women, can have that kind of travel experience today. And I've got a lot of friends that have, if they just hit the road and have their outdoor explorer adventures, you know. But you've got to take the initiative. It takes some initiative, but you know, once you get committed to it and once you get on the road, boy, you don't look back. You're glad you did.
Yeah. Iran is one of the countries on my list of places I'd like to go. That is the opportunity has not been right.
You know, you'd be surprised, Martha. There, I don't know exactly what it's like now, but there's a Lonely Planet guidebook to Iran and it sells quite well. and it sells to English people and Germans and Australians and so on. Americans don't go there because of our politics, but right. we're just as welcome as a German. Cuba is another example. I mean, Cuba, Americans don't go to Cuba, but it's the number one resort in the Caribbean for Canadians and Germans. They go there all the time. And, you know, if you go to Cuba, you're going to have an amazing time. Just like Iran. We made a TV show about Iran, which, by the way, people can stream on Alaskan Public Media or at ricksteves.com. But it's some of the most rewarding travels I've ever had. And going there is not endorsing their government. Going there is getting to know the 70 million people that have to live under it. You know, it's a theocracy there because of their fear of incursions from the West, which is a reasonable fear. They have traded away their democracy, and now they have a theocracy that rules that country in a way that won't have their culture kidnapped by Western values. That's totally their right. And I was in the streets of Tehran, and never forget, a woman came up to me and she said, "Are you a journalist?" I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, I want you to go home and tell the truth. We're strong, we're united, and we just don't want our little girls to be raised like Britney Spears." And I thought, oh, boy, I think I've connected here with something. And, you know, she was the base, you know, the frightened base of Iran that because of social media and because of pop culture and because of the history of incursions from the West and the United States putting the Shah on the throne and all that kind of stuff, she was worried that if we threw out the Ayatollah and put on a puppet government from the West, her little girl would become a boy toy and a drug addict and a crass materialist. And she was scared. She was just scared. And she was the small town, less educated fundamentalist. And we have small town, less educated fundamentalists in our country, and they're scared too. And we got to remember, these people are good people, riddled with fear and motivated by love. It's a very, very realistic concern they have. And when we travel, we get to know each other. And we can realize we don't all need to be enemies. We can live together on this beautiful planet.
Absolutely. Shifting gears just a little bit. Earlier this year, I did a show talking about climate change, which is something that's a big deal to Alaskans, especially those who rely on subsistence hunting and fishing to feed their families. And while we tend to get very focused on what's happening in our immediate communities, it's really important to remember that climate change is a global issue. Your company is really committed to combating climate change, and I just want to touch on that. But first, what sort of impacts from climate change have you noticed in your travels across the world, especially considering that you return to some destinations over and over again?
Yeah. Well, we are so privileged, and I'm kind of keenly aware of that these days, and we get to travel. And we get to travel and complain about the impact of climate change, meaning, you know, you can't have a ski lift without having plumbing so you can make snow. You can't go shopping without canvas over the streets in Madrid so you don't get sunburned. In England now, towns on the coast have little dams that they raise up on the streets at the bottom of the town so that when the higher tide comes in, it doesn't flood the town. The Dutch are spending, you know, lots and lots of money fortifying their dikes. Bullfights are now later at night. So they used to buy bullfight tickets in the shade or in the sun. That was the big deal. Now it's so hot, everything's in the shade. Italians never used to go to Sweden. Now Sweden has a lot of Italians in August because Italians are just trying to escape. Germany still doesn't have air conditioning, and they need air conditioning. It's 90 degrees a day, every day, hot and muggy for all of August. Many times I've been having my lunch. No, I've been having a beer and a pretzel late in the afternoon, and you have this muggy monsoon kind of thing building up, and suddenly it hits and everybody grabs their beer and their pretzel and they run for cover. This is the weirdest thing, but it's a routine when I'm in Germany at a beer garden now. I wait for the monsoon to hit late in the afternoon and bam, you grab your beer and you run for cover. That never happened before. Well, this is all climate change impacting, you know, wealthy people who like to go out and have a big beer in Germany. But I've also made a TV show about called Hunger and Hope, Lessons Learned in Ethiopia and Guatemala. And I've walked with farmers across parched land and talked with them about how climate change is just totally screwing up their ability to work their land effectively and even plant on in the next year because they're having such a difficult time with drought and this sort of thing. And climate change is real. I guess that's what it's all about. And as travelers, we are contributing to it mightily. So it'd be horrible if all I did was complain about climate change and why we should do something. And then I take people to Europe on tours. We took, as I said, 25,000 people we talked into going to Europe who could have gone fishing and contributed nothing to climate change. And I don't want to be flight shamed out of my travels, because I want to live a full life, and travel's a big part of it, and we can learn from travel. And I think travel's a really important source for stability and peace on this planet. But it's unethical for me as a tour organizer to take people to Europe without paying for the carbon we create. I wish my government taxed me for that. It's very straightforward, but no, that's not the American way of stoking the economy. So as a tour organizer who wants to be ethical, and I hesitate to brag about this, it's nothing heroic, it's just baseline ethics, I should tax myself $30 per person for what it costs to mitigate one person's travel from the United States to Europe and back. I know from scientific journals that I've read that if you smartly invest $30 as an American, you mitigate the bad you create by flying to Europe and back by creating that much good when it comes to carbon problems. So what we do is we take, excuse me, this takes a few minutes to explain, but it's really important. We have a program called the Rick Steves Climate Smart Initiative, and we donate $30 per person that we take to Europe to organizations that help developing world farmers farm in a way that contributes less to climate change. So we took 30,000 people to Europe the other year, and we $30 per person, that's 900,000. We rounded up to $1 million. We have 10 organizations we want to support. So we give each of them $100,000, and they invest it in the developing world for forestry projects and to help farmers do their work in a way that is more productive and less impactful to climate change. So there's a fine point here, Martha. We're not helping pay people to overcome the horrible results of climate change. That's a legitimate cause. We are investing in farmers to do their work going forward in a way that's better for the climate. And the conventional thing here in the United States is to pay for carbon offsets and so on. And that's just investing in developed world industries. And that's fine if you want to, but I wanted to be a little more clever and entrepreneurial with my philanthropy. So what I want to do is help farmers in the poor world. Half of humanity is poor, smallholder farm families trying to live on $5 a day. They're desperate to feed their kids and have a little left over for the market. And they contribute a lot to climate change with their practices. But if we can help them have more efficient stoves and have climate smart seeds, and if we can, and to keep the topsoil by having more trees and so on, we can help them contribute less to climate change. So we've been doing that now for 4 years. We've spent $3 million on this. And going forward, we're going to do it again. Every year we give $1 million, assuming we take about 30,000 people to Europe. And I think it's the ethical thing for a tour company to do. And on my website at ricksteves.com in the Climate Smart section, right at the top, it says, if you're a tour organizer, steal this program and use it and don't credit us. It's just, we got to get serious about climate change. And those of us in the tourist industry need to get double serious about it.
What about people who, individuals who love to travel, other than working with companies or supporting companies that care about this issue, such as your company and yourself? Right. Do you have recommendations for what individuals who love to travel can do to help combat this?
Yeah, the way I understand it, and every scientific kind of assessment agrees with what I've learned, is if an American invests $30 smartly, they mitigate the carbon a flight from here to Europe and back costs. So what you could do is, if you go to ricksteves.com, you look at our portfolio, you'll see the 10 organizations that we support. Two or three of them are advocacy organizations, and that is, they lobby for climate smart policies in Washington, D.C. And the rest help in a very effective way communities in the global South deal with climate change. It's funny, just an hour ago before you and I got on the phone together, I was meeting with the leaders in my company, and we really want to help individual travelers do what we're doing for the people who take a Rick Steves bus tour. So we're going to have a link on our website where people can choose, you know, review the different organizations that we've vetted and we like, and they'll have a way, very easy way, just to click and donate $30 for their trip. And then they will travel with the comfort of knowing that you're at least flying in a carbon neutral way. And I just think that's so exciting. There's ways to do it. I wish it was easier. I wish the government just built it into the cost of a flight, because that would be honest accounting. Right. But we don't do that. So we need to do it as individuals. And I might say, regardless of your politics, if you care about the environment, I think the environment's a fairly big deal in Alaska.
Very much so.
You know, people confuse short-term financial interests with long-term sustainability. And I really believe for the cost of what we're going to do to clean up after this Hurricane Ian in Florida and so on, think of what that cost. If we just took some of the money we're going to be spending in the future cleaning up after avoidable hurricanes and invested it in retooling our economy and helping people who will be hurt when we retool the economy, it would be a very smart investment, and we wouldn't have communities that are at sea level being inundated, and we wouldn't have communities that are built on frozen tundra all of a sudden falling into oblivion. This is a serious issue. It's not in the future. It is right now, and it takes American leadership, and that takes a citizenry here in this country to support politicians that are honest about this. Is it honest, or is it just tokenism and then appealing to our short-term greed? That's between you and your ballot.
So the moral of the story is vote.
Absolutely. Vote, and vote with a keen interest, I would say, on what is the impact of this candidate's policies on sustainable environmental issues, climate change.
Short-term financial gain versus long-term environmental impacts is something that we fight over a lot here in Alaska. Yep. That has been
it's understandable. It's understandable. People have, everybody's struggling to pay, make ends meet, you know, but we on a global scale, we are a wealthy corner here. And on a global scale, there needs to be leadership in making this, our world inhabitable in three generations.
Absolutely.
And I think things are accelerating, and we're not on a good trajectory the way things are going right now.
Agreed.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Moving on to slightly happier topics, much happier topics. You have a new show out that's called The Art of Europe. It's a big story to tell. What inspired you to tell this story? And you did it in 6 hour long episodes, which I think is pretty impressive considering the amount of time you covered.
Yeah. Well, one art history class is 50 hours at school. And I just wanted to give people a nice, tight 6 hour sweep through the story of Europe from a tour guide's kind of perspective. And I'm so thankful I've got my gig with public television and I can assume an attention span, and I can respect people's intelligence and bring home programming that's not designed to keep advertisers happy, but that is designed to just inspire people to reach out and embrace the world in all its beauty. And big part of that beauty is art. And as a tour guide, I just love art. And as a tour guide, I know that for a lot of people, it's kind of like, oh, not another Madonna and Child. And I know after years of tour guiding how many Madonnas and Children a tourist can enjoy before their eyes glaze over, you know? And when I was a kid, my mom said, oh, you got to go to the museums. And I went to the museums and I was surrounded by people looking like they were having a good time. And I was convinced they were just faking it. And I remember I was at the UW in Haggard Hall and sitting in the cafeteria with my friends, and we got out the class catalog for the next quarter. And I was thinking, what would be the most boring class you could probably take? And I thought, it's got to be art history. I mean, who would take this stuff? But then I went to Europe, had some great guides. I took some art history class and I had a great professor, and I became so enthusiastic about it. When I was in my 20s, I would go all over the country teaching a 2-day seminar, all day Saturday, the skills, all day Sunday, History and Art. It was a 6-hour sweep through the story of art for travelers. That was way back in the 80s. And now I get to do that as a TV producer. And we drew from 20 years of footage that we've made doing our TV shows in all the great palaces, galleries, museums in Europe. And then I went back 3 times this last year, and we've put together a 6-hour series that's airing all over the country. It's airing on Alaska Public Media, I believe, Sunday mornings at 9 a.m., and you can stream it. It's brand new, and it was really fun, Martha, to kind of limit it to 6 hours. If it was Ken Burns, I could have gone 26 hours, but I have to make it tight, and I want to make it tight. And the first hour is from cave paintings through ancient Greece. The second hour is ancient Rome, 1,000 years from 500 BC to 500 AD. It grows for 500 years, it peaks for 200 years, and it falls for 300 years. It's a little more complicated than that. The third hour is medieval European art, and that goes from 500 to 1,500, 1,000 years, glorious Gothic cathedrals, and so on. The fourth hour is the Renaissance. That's about a 200-year stretch from 1,400 to 1,600. Show number five is Baroque, 1600 to about 1800. And Baroque is the art of the propaganda art of the old regime, this whole notion that you have divine monarchs. Back when people believed God said your king is ordained by God to rule you without question on earth. And Louis XIV, he'd spend half a year's income of his entire country of France to build his palace. He would reroute rivers to power his fountains. He was the only guy that could grow oranges in Paris because he was ruling with God's support, and he wanted to prove that. And he created this hall of mirrors that was more mirrors that had ever been put together in one space than anybody had ever seen, with lavish gold leaf trimmings. And above, you'd have these glorious paintings showing your king hobnobbing with the heavenly host. And you were just so thankful to be ruled by this guy. And of course, power corrupts and they moved too far. And Marie Antoinette was saying, let them eat cake, when the peasants said we're hungry. And they grabbed the king and the queen, cut off their heads, and decapitated the old regime. And here comes the revolution. And the politically correct art of that age was neoclassical, in a time when everything was subjected to the test of reason. So you have that neoclassical flip side of Baroque. So that's 1 hour, and that's a fun story to tell. And then the final hour is modern Europe, from the Romantic Age in the 1850s, the Impressionists, and then it all breaks into little genres and little styles, and you got all the isms of the 20th century. And it was so fun to put this together and to be privileged enough to go to these great museums and galleries with the camera rolling and make it tight. It's beautiful, and it's airing all over the country. And I am one happy tour guide to be able to share this for people who are able to sit at home, and thanks to public television, enjoy a 6-hour sweep through the story of European art.
That's wonderful. In the first episode, which I actually just watched this morning because I discovered that it was streaming on your website, you visit some ancient grave mounds and you talk about how they are oriented to be lit up on the inside by sun, either when the sun rises on the shortest day or when the sun sets on the longest day. And to me, that seems like it would take, at the time that those were built, it seems like it would take an intimate connection to nature and the world around you to even come up with how to do that, right? There were no tools where they knew that it was this day of the year and this is how they measured that. How does this sort of evolution of art show us how our relationship and connectedness to nature and the natural world has kind of changed over the centuries? Because I think it goes from that to some like impressionism and some more abstract art, which is just a totally different ballgame.
It is mind-blowing. And we track, with the art, we track the development of Western civilization and its relationship with nature and its relationship with God and its relationship with war and social issues and economic issues and so on. And what you watched that first hour, that was what I like to inspire people to do is approach art like somebody who lived then, not to look at it through 2022 eyes, but to look at it like a person who lived in prehistoric times with a torch that would bend down and walk into this, down this tunnel, and then stand up in under a dome like we did in Orkney north of Scotland, and to think that 20,000 years ago people stooped to walk through the little tunnel that I just walked through. And they knew that on that shortest day of the year or that longest day of the year, for 10 minutes, the sun would shine down this passageway. And what would happen? Would that, is that when the sun came in there, was that when it picked up the soul of their dead loved one and take it to heaven or what? I don't know. But there's that kind of wonder, and you get that. And you can imagine being a medieval pilgrim hiking for weeks, and then you see on the horizon the lacy spires of that Gothic cathedral, and then you know in there is a thorn from the crown of thorns, what would that have been like? And you could go out to the Palace of Versailles, which I was talking about a minute ago, 300 years ago, and you could just be wowed by your king and be thankful for that. Or you could be in the surrealistic age just 100 years ago, and you could go, whoa, Salvador Dali, was he on drugs or what? And he would say, I am the drug. You know, so there's all of this fun that you can get into with the art. And as a tour guide, you know, I've got 100 guides that help me take all these people on 40 different tours all over Europe every year. We get together every year and share our favorite tools for teaching art. And we share them. And as a tour guide, I never take a group into the Pantheon in Rome without having four tourists get together and put their arms around this one piece granite column. There's 16 of them in the portico. It takes four human beings to circle it with their arms stretched out. And then I remind them, this was carved 2000 years ago it's a single piece of granite quarried in Egypt. And they put it on a big rowboat and essentially rowed it from Egypt to Rome and set it up there with 15 other such columns. And that's just the front porch. And you step into that, and you step into the building that gives you a feeling for the magnificence and the splendor of Rome better than any other. 2,000 years old. It's a perfect circle inside a perfect square, 140 feet wide, 140 feet tall, with a big sunlight in the top that just brings this amazing beam of sunlight through. And you think of being there as a Roman 1,800 years ago, when this was a pantheon, a temple to all the gods. And you walk in today as a tourist or a pilgrim, and you can see how, wow, when that beam came down, what a cool connection between our lives here as mortals on earth and what was going on up in heaven. So it's just a rough and tumble sweep through the story of Europe. And one thing about it is just flat out beautiful to see all the stuff we've done. And a lot of people ask me for a budget tip. You know, it costs so much to go into the Vatican Museum. How can I get a better deal? We're all going to pay the same price. But those who know what they're looking at, they enjoy it about five times as much. And my mission in life is to help people know what they're looking at and enjoy it about five times as much. And they don't even have to travel to Europe. Now you can just watch it on Alaska Public Media.
Yeah, it's a big story to tell. And I've only watched one episode, but having been to some of those places, you do it justice.
I got to demonstrate the acoustics in those old theaters.
Yes, yeah.
And imagine 10,000 people gathering there with no amplification, but you stand there in the middle and you give a little speech, which I get to do because I'm a tour guide, and people on the top row clap.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. I'm sure that you are frequently asked what your favorite piece of art is, but I want to know what your most underwhelming art moment is, because I have one and it's controversial.
My most underwhelming art moment. Well, what I don't like is to be trampled by people with selfie sticks and cameras in front of Mona Lisa. I like Mona Lisa, but the problem with Mona Lisa is it's mobbed by people that have no interest in art. They just want to get a picture taken of them in front of that. And in Europe, that's a big challenge lately. There's just armies of people that want to get a selfie and they don't even know the name of the town they're in. So yeah. That's my most underwhelming experience. What's yours?
Ironically, I'm going to tell you that it's Mona Lisa. I just was not a big fan. There were many things right. that I enjoyed immensely much more. Mona Lisa was not one of them. I was also a teenager at the time, but it my grandma shares this opinion, so I feel at least she's much older than me. I feel slightly justified in that.
Well, Martha, Mona Lisa is underwhelming because it's so famous. It's behind bulletproof glass. It's surrounded by a mob of people, and it's pretty small and a little murky. Mm-hmm. But I'll just give you a little background, so maybe that you can give Leonardo a little extra chance here. Mona Lisa was the wife of a merchant instead of a noblewoman or some goddess or something like that. So it was kind of a statement that this was humanism. This is, you know, we're all equally, deserving children of God and so on. She's sitting like on a balcony at as a pyramid and at a three-quarter angle. So she has mass and she's very realistic. And if you look in the background, the landscape, it's this mystical Leonardo style landscape. And he doesn't do the simple linear perspective where you have a tree lined road going back to a vanishing point. He analyzes how the color changes when there's more atmosphere between your eye and it. And the more distant things are murkier with their color. And he analyzes that kind of depth. And when we think about Leonardo's Mona Lisa, I think we need to remember he had the advantage of oil-based paints instead of egg-based paints. That was coming about just about during his lifetime. And he was able to get that fine sort of mystery, that what's called sfumato, all of that modeling in her face, giving her that enigmatic smile where you don't know quite what she's thinking or is she smiling. And it's the one piece of art that Leonardo kept with him until he died. He spent his last years in the court of the King of France in Amboise in the Loire Valley. And he loved the Mona Lisa, his painting. And when he died, his buddy, the King of France, Francois I, had got to take that painting. And today it hangs in, not in Italy, but in France, because Leonardo took it with him to France. And now it's the centerpiece, really, of the biggest museum, maybe in the world, the Louvre Museum in Paris. But Mona Lisa is, it's funny, everybody goes to see that. And I think there's more. There's piles of paintings within a 5-minute walk of Mona Lisa that are every bit as exciting if people would just broaden their view.
Yeah, I'll give her another chance if I ever get to see her again. But I certainly think that I agree. There's
better.
Especially in that museum. The Louvre is a fantastic museum.
And you know, just behind, Martha, just behind Mona, she's in the Renaissance area, but just two rooms away, you've got a beautiful hall filled with romantic paintings and a beautiful hall filled with neoclassical paintings. And I just love neoclassicism. And that's the revolutionary art, Napoleon kind of art. And then I also love the romantic paintings. Those are from the middle of the 1800s, where the romantic artists were kind of the natural cheerleaders of national underdog causes. So you got all these small ethnic groups trying to get a country. And, you know, to this day, there are people, a lot of people who just don't have their own country. They're called nations without states, nations without states. And, you know, when, after some war, they drew a line and they said, okay, the French people go here and the Spanish people go there. And the Basque people go, well, wait a minute. What about us? No, just learn to speak French, or you guys learn to speak Spanish. It's not that easy. And those little ethnic groups, they're the ones that had those, you know, dramatic challenges back in the Romantic age. And there were romantic painters right there to capture that, those tumultuous times. And you see that in the art. You see that with Géricault and Delacroix, and you see that in Spain with Goya. And one thing I like to do before I go in any country to get into the great outdoors, I like to go to the National Museum in the capital and look at paintings from the Romantic age that celebrate the great outdoors. And then I can appreciate the great outdoors of Norway or of Ireland or of Switzerland with a little bit of more cultural insight, which I think really helps.
I like that approach a lot.
Yeah.
On that note, Rick, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on to Outdoor Explorer.
Well, thank you.
You can find more information about Rick and his new show on ricksteves.com. If you're looking for your next adventure or you just want to read about someone else's while you stick closer to home, I also definitely recommend checking out his travel blog, which is also on his website. He has released some of the journal passages from the book that he mentioned on the trip that you took from Istanbul to
the hippie trail.
Yeah, that was, I enjoyed reading those.
Well, so thank you. And yeah. We do have a party every Monday night. It's free. And we've been doing it ever since COVID started. And we just go somewhere in Europe with some great host and we eat and drink together. And several of them have been about these great hikes that I've enjoyed. So if you're interested in the great outdoors of Europe, we archive all of those. So there's 80 of those that people can check out. And all of the TV shows we've ever made are available for streaming just fast and free, right? Easy at ricksteves.com. So there's a lot of information there for people who are dreaming about traveling.
Yeah, it was nice to, I don't have any international travel on my docket coming up anytime soon, but it was nice to watch some of those videos and nice. Dream about where I'm going to go next and what I'm going to do next.
That's great. Well, Martha, thank you so much. It's been a delight talking with you.
And yes, thank you.
Best wishes and happy travels to all of your listeners.
Thank you so much. That's all for today's show. A huge thank you to my guest, Rick Steves. You can find his new show, The Art of Europe, streaming on ricksteves.com or Sundays at 9 a.m. on Alaska Public Media Television. You can find more information about Rick and any links we mentioned in today's show on the Outdoor Explorer page at alaskapublic.org. Thank you to our producer, Eric Bork, and from all the hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thank you for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.